Here this morning, counsel, we're familiar with your cases. We've read your briefs, the authority cited in your briefs. We've looked at the record. So you don't have a lot of time this morning, 15 minutes aside. Get straight to the heart of your argument. We're probably going to have some questions, but be mindful of our traffic light system. When the red light shines, it is time to stop. If you're answering a question from the court, though, you can, of course, finish your answer. And sometimes we do go over time. You're on our time when that happens. And you'll save your rebuttal time if rebuttal time is something you have. Our first case this morning is United States versus Fay and Gunner. Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I go to the podium?
Please.
Counsel, the court. Good morning, Joseph R. Johnson, on behalf of David Chappelle Fay. The first issue I wanted to address, which is number one in my brief, is the 404B issue. And as far as the 404B is concerned, there's kind of two parts to that that we were particularly concerned about during the trial. One of them is we had no 404B notice filed ever by the United States, which means it had to be.
You had a 404B notice, right? But it just didn't include Reed's testimony being identified as 404B evidence.
Well, there was a 404B notice on prior drug activities, but there was right. No 404B notice regarding Mr. Joshua Reed and the fact that information came out approximately.
Yeah, they didn't identify Reed's testimony as 404B evidence, right?
Correct, and I think there is at least an argument that that's a waiver, and it certainly put the defense in a difficult.
Well, but they did describe that evidence in their pretrial brief.
They did describe it as the.
And they asked for, when they had jury instructions, proposed jury instructions, they filed the same day. That addressed it as consciousness of guilt evidence, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that was included. So they did that.
So if they had identified it as 404B evidence, what would have been any different? I mean, you knew about the evidence. You knew from the jury instructions filed the same day as the pretrial brief that it was going to be considered, that they wanted it to be considered as consciousness of evidence, consciousness of guilt evidence. This looks to me like harmless error.
My point on that issue is the government's favorite word appears to be waiver. And if you make an objection as defense counsel, you've got to not only state the grounds for the objection, but you can't just later throw in whatever you want. And it's kind of the opposite
of doing
that.
I mean, this isn't a situation where you weren't apprised of what they were going to do. They may not have identified it as 404B required. Subparagraph 3 required with written notice as 404B evidence, but they did everything else, okay. It seems to me. Am I wrong about that?
I think you summed it up fairly accurately. The main thrust of my issue really gets down to the fact that we just think that this was admitted primarily for propensity and character rather than anything else. And as I'm sure you know, there was a proffer when the jury was taken out where the testimony of Mr. Reed was taken. And during that testimony, first of all, he perjured himself or he did it inadvertently, I don't know. But anyway, he's made incorrect statements during that testimony. One was when I asked if he had been promised anything by Mr. Fay, and he said that he had not. And then on further cross, he admitted that he'd been promised a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. Another one was I asked him if he had told the officers that he was hoping for anything or wanted anything as a result of his cooperation. He finally admitted that he was interested in hoping that he could have a sentence reduction. The proffer itself, the judge found Mr. Reed to be credible, but it seemed to be based solely upon the fact that they were incarcerated together in the Marion County Jail and in the same area at one point in time. So other than that fact, that seems to be the only credibility determination that the court made, that it was possible that they had met and talked while incarcerated in the Marion County Jail in Ocala, Florida. But I would argue that that does not by any way lend credibility to the actual testimony itself, just that it could have happened, that they met together.
Well, he gave a detailed account of their meeting, right?
Yes,
and,
sir.
And the district court credited it. Don't we really have to defer to its credibility determination?
I would argue in this case it's an abuse of discretion, because the standard he was using was basically just a standard of it possibly could have happened, rather than saying he was specifically credible about anything as far as the story of wanting Mr. Fay wanting him to burn down the trailer with Marcia Jennings inside and all that well, information.
All the district court had to decide, though, was that it was credible enough for a jury to consider it, and then the jury gets to decide whether it wants to believe it or not, right?
I think if it's offered primarily for propensity and character evidence.
But what if it's offered as consciousness of guilt evidence? I mean, there was a limiting instruction, right?
Yes, sir, there was. And I still think it was just when you do the Rule 403 part of the balancing test at the end of 404 evidence.
We assume juries follow instructions. The jury was told you're to consider it for that limited purpose, not as propensity evidence.
They were, but it would be our position that at that point a limiting instruction was insufficient, and that 403 would be substantially more prejudicial than probative under 403, given the lack of credibility of Mr. Reed.
Well, let me ask you something about the alleged lack of credibility. Isn't it true that Jennings was also under security and protection by the federal government as a result of these things that Reed told the government?
Well, that is true. After they found out about the alleged statements of Mr. Reed, then yes,
right,
they took her and put her in a hotel or something so that she couldn't be located.
I mean, isn't that also a fair indication of some credibility? At least the government seemed to have believed her enough to pay money to secure her and guard her? And wasn't the court allowed to rely on that as well?
I don't think that really establishes any credibility. I think it's just kind of a common sense thing to do. If there, no matter how valid you think a threat may or may not be.
Well, I can tell you that the government does not personally secure people just because somebody said there's a threat. I mean, that just doesn't, it's not as easy as someone saying there's a threat and there's security. You know, the government doesn't pay to put somebody up and guard somebody. Just because they did it doesn't mean there was a threat. But it's not as easy as someone just saying a threat, that there is a threat and that now there's going to be security.
Well, many threats are more generic, I think, in the general sense, where all these drug cases where you have somebody say that, okay, there, you know, I can't talk or I'm going to be killed or my family's going to be hurt or things like this. This was a very specific threat, so I understand why they acted upon it. But, you know, at that point, Mr. Fay had been continually incarcerated. They obviously found out what was the allegations were from Mr. Reed. And I also wanted to get into what I think is with the Joshua Green situation is kind of a backdoor 404B. That's issue three, regarding the fact that they pointed out that the government elicited testimony from the case agent that Mr. Green died from a drug overdose.
Yeah, but I mean, lots of people die from drug overdoses. That's not necessarily evidence that you know it was attributable to your client.
That's kind of what Judge Antone said, but I don't see that. I mean, lots of people do die from a drug overdose, but not in a case where you have someone who was allegedly involved in actually committing the murder.
Didn't a medical examiner testify earlier that day that overdoses from fentanyl were common in that area?
They did at some time. I don't know whether it was earlier that day or not, but they did testify at one point that they were common in that in the Ocala area.
Yeah.
I don't know what that translates into on an annual basis, but when you have a case where somebody was specifically killed by a hot shot being methamphetamine and fentanyl, when you put that information before the jury, it appears to me that that's an engraved invitation to speculate about, well, how did, you know, maybe Mr. Green was killed with a hot shot too. So the court didn't obviously go along with that, but our argument would be that it was an abuse of discretion to allow that. It was totally unnecessary for the state. They could have just said he died.
Okay.
I just have a quick question. I thought you also argued that the government acted in bad faith in destroying lab results related to Ms. Brown's death. I was hoping you could speak to that, given that at the time of the autopsy, it was determined that she died of a mix of methamphetamine and fentanyl and that it was an accidental overdose. But now it appears on appeal you're arguing that the government, even at the time of her autopsy, was already considering your client as a suspect.
They were, because the death happened in 2016. But the Florida Department of Law Enforcement had already conducted a covert recorded interview with a different person at the jail, and the recording was played in the trial. And during that, I think it was about an hour long, there was a fairly lengthy description by Mr. Fay of what a hot shot was. And during that, he said a lot of things, like he was former CIA and the mayor of a town worked for him, and he had people at the clerk of the court. And then part of it was a detailed description of what a hot shot was. So it was clear that they were investigating Mr. Fay for a homicide. And all they had to do was probably make a phone call to the medical examiner's office and ask that those particular tissue samples be
That goes to what I understood your argument to be. I understood that your argument was not that the government had acted in bad faith. You didn't really have evidence of that. It was that this was their negligence.
I had asked, I would say that is probably more appropriate to use, although...
Now, let me ask you this. Have we ever approved... the use of a spoliation instruction in a criminal trial, because I can't find any precedent of our court that approves that, and it looks to me like this is a plain error issue.
I had the only cases that I've seen, and I'm not sure they're from the 11th Circuit, when there was proof of particularly. It was done maliciously.
Bad faith.
I can't say for sure that it was done maliciously, but then again, I wasn't asking for the evidence to be excluded. I was just asking for a jury instruction on this is what happened, and you know the government had the authority to save that evidence if they had so properly conducted their jobs, basically.
Okay. If there aren't any further questions, let's you save 5 minutes for rebuttal. Let's hear from Ms. Taylor.
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, Michelle Taylor for the United States. The evidence that Faye sought to solicit the murder of the key witness against him, the eyewitness who saw the murder of Kristen Brown, is not extrinsic other crime evidence.
It's 5 years after the murder happened, right? After the completion of the conspiracy. How is that intrinsic?
This is actually, if you think of, for instance, there's a bank robbery and the defendant's running out of the bank and shoots the eyewitness as he's running out of the bank because he's trying to conceal his crime. Or imagine that he finds out about the eyewitness.
This isn't that at all. This is 5 years after the fact, soliciting someone to murder a witness. This is a cover-up act, which we've always, as far as I can tell under our precedents, we've always treated as extrinsic and governed by 404B.
Actually, Your Honor, I would disagree with that. If you go back to the Ballard case in the former Fifth in 1970, escape in jail after the crime was over, the defendant was in jail on a robbery, and he then escaped from jail. And the court said that this was consciousness of guilt evidence that could show guilt itself. Didn't say anything about 404B. And then Borders in 1982.
Did it describe it as intrinsic for purposes of 404B?
I think the holding that it shows guilt itself is a holding that
consciousness of evidence guilt though could be extrinsic and governed by 404B.
The court has looked at it in both ways, and in sometimes, for instance, in the Troia case.
Can you show? Well, all right, where have we described something like this? A solicitation to kill a witness 5 years after the fact as intrinsic under 404B?
I don't have a solicitation to kill the witness 5 years after the fact, but the gap in time here is not really relevant because the gap in time was resulted from the fact that Faye was successful in making this look like an overdose for a number of years, an accidental overdose. The gap in time might matter more if there was like flight evidence that took place years after the crime where you don't know if he's still fleeing for the same reason. But here there's a direct tie to the crime itself. He's trying to conceal the murder of Kristen Brown. And his solicitation of that murder is an admission by conduct that she was there that night, that she knew what happened, and that she could incriminate him. So it's direct evidence of the crime itself here. And the jury, you know, another way of looking at it is, you know, intrinsic evidence, is that necessary to complete the story? The jury was entitled to hear the rest of the story here because
You and I may agree about that. I think that this evidence is admissible as consciousness of guilt evidence, but I just don't understand how it's intrinsic.
Well, if I could just add that to continue the rest of the story, that's one of the ways courts find evidence.
What difference does it make if even if it was 404B evidence? Let's assume it was 404B evidence for purposes of this question. What would your argument be about why it wasn't reversible error for the district court to admit it?
Well, if it was 404B evidence, and this court has treated consciousness of guilt evidence as a permissible purpose under 404B, the notice here actually was sufficient. So I would disagree with Judge Pryor about the error being harmless. I think there was no error at all.
Well, I looked at your filing. Your filing described 404B evidence and did not describe this as that evidence, right?
That's right, because we took the view that it was intrinsic and not.
Yeah, so you didn't really, under 404B3, provide written notice that this would be 404B evidence, right?
I think if you look at the trial brief, where we said we outlined what the facts were, and we said that this showed his effort to conceal the crime.
Yeah.
And then you look at the proposed jury instructions that were filed the same day.
Yeah.
Where we cite the Smith case and we actually quote.
But you didn't call it 404B evidence, but you did everything else. That's why I view this as harmless error.
Well, in the proposed jury instruction, it does say that the court has found it admissible under 404B. 404B actually appears in the proposed jury instruction.
Yeah.
So the defendant, when you talk about the notice provision,
I agree with you. You did everything else, but I agree with that.
And the notice doesn't require any particular form of notice. It just says so that the defendant has a fair opportunity to meet the evidence. And that happened here. The defendant responded to the trial brief in terms of 404B, and they said, well, intent could be.
Yeah, Ms. Taylor, the problem I have is, though, that you filed a pretrial brief, the prosecution filed a pretrial brief that with a caption about 404B evidence and described 404B evidence, and this wasn't in the description. I agree. In the facts section, you described this evidence. I agree, and the jury instructions filed the same day, you know, you had consciousness of guilt evidence outlined there, and this being it, and a limiting instruction, all that. So it seems to me you did everything but specifically identified as 404B evidence, which is why I view this as harmless error.
I'd also like to point out, though, that the district court found repeatedly that the notice was adequate, and it was in the best position to evaluate whether notice was adequate. It was, you know,
I agree. They had plenty of notice about this.
Yeah.
Whether it specifically complied with the rule is a technicality, maybe.
Well, as the court said, to say that there should have been a particular label would elevate form over substance. He got the notice.
I mean, y'all gave a particular label to 404B evidence. You just didn't put this in there. That's my point.
I essentially think the proposed jury instruction gives you the 404B label because it quotes it as part of the Smith case, and Smith is a 404B case. So I think that the notice here was sufficient. He responded in 404B terms. So I don't think there's a real notice problem under 404B. And the court could admit it under 404B. Courts, for instance, in the Troia case, a court found that evidence was admissible both as intrinsic and under 404B. So you have both alternatives here.
Counsel, would you agree, though, let's say that Reed's testimony was improperly admitted. What else in the record do you point to support the ultimate finding, nevertheless, regarding this conspiracy to kill her?
Oh, well, we had lots of other evidence in addition to the Reed testimony. For instance, you have the original Zachary statements in 2016, where Faye talked, he blamed the crime on his wife, but he said that he described how hot shots could be administered and people could be given fentanyl and their bodies could be moved. Then you have Gunter's statements in 2016 and 2020, where she places Jennings and she admits even hiding in the closet. She doesn't admit that she participated in the crime, but she confirms everything from Jennings' account. And then, of course, the most compelling evidence is Jennings' testimony itself, the eyewitness testimony of Jennings that she saw what happened that night. And Jennings' testimony is confirmed by a lot of the other evidence. For instance, the phone records where Faye answers the phone that night after Brown and Faye had stopped by at Browning's house to look for the person they thought, Amanda Watson, the person they thought had stolen drugs. So the timeline lines up, and Gunter admitted their presence at Green's presence and Jennings' presence. And then Faye's story, his 2020 account is incredibly compelling, where he, again, is trying to blame the crime on his wife, but the fact that Faye sought for Arnold to lie to the police about Faye's presence at the cemetery is pretty compelling evidence he's trying to cover up his role. And the statement that Arnold talked about and that Faye admitted in his account that Gunter called him and said, it's done, indicates a conspiracy and an agreement that they're going to, you know.
So you had and were able to introduce Reed's testimony, but it sounds like you really didn't need it in order to support your case.
I think it was necessary here, given Faye and Gunter's attempt to portray Jennings as the real murderer. They were suggesting you could have killed it. And it was, you know, given their strategy, it was really important for the jury to hear the rest of the story that, in fact, Faye had sought to have Jennings killed. There would be no reason, if she was the real murderer, for him to try to kill her. That shows.
Therefore, in terms of 404B's requirement of written notice, it does become more important for you to check the boxes because, as you just said, you all were nevertheless heavily relying on Reed's testimony.
I think it was important to undermine that claim that Jennings was the real murderer. And I think if the jury hadn't been able to hear the whole story, the jury would have been handicapped in trying to figure out what happened that night. But I also think that even if we didn't have it, the evidence here was overwhelming, and I think that this court could affirm, even if there was error. But I don't think there was error at all. And so that's the the 404B intrinsic issue. The second question on Green, as Judge Pryor pointed out, that early, it was in fact earlier that same day. It's Doc 294 at 127 that the medical examiner said that there's been a sky-high number of overdose deaths. She even says on the number of one per day. So there was no suggestion at all that that was like somehow, you know, a suggestion that Faye and Gunter had killed Green. It was just context. So there was no error there at all, certainly not prosecutorial misconduct.
I realize the defense asked for, in pretrial, asked for the jury instruction on spoliation, but they did not renew that request at the time for charging. So it seems to me that the failure to give that instruction is reviewed for plain error. And as far as I can tell, we've never said that a spoliation instruction should be used at all in a criminal trial. It's not to say, I mean, some other circuits have. One circuit has reserved the issue in a plain error situation, too. But even when it has been used, it's always required a showing of bad faith, not just negligence.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. I believe that Ariel case would support the plain error because it was a pretrial request in that case wasn't enough. And
right.
And you're correct. I believe in the Lanzone case, the court said that even assuming that spoliation would apply in this context, it wouldn't apply based on a showing of negligence. And that is the most that would ever be alleged here, although I don't even think that there is negligence shown in this case. At least certainly there wasn't at the point at which the district court was asked to make a pretrial finding.
Opposing counsel, though, does emphasize the fact that the government was investigating Mr. Faye at the time of Ms. Brown's death and therefore was aware that he was a possible and perhaps the only suspect. So if that is true, number one, do you agree with that? And then that's number one. And then number two, if that is true, then how is it just negligence or not negligence not to have at least retained that information so then when Mr. Faye was actually charged, he would have an opportunity to challenge that particular evidence?
Well, I think in 2016, you do have Zachary's statements. This is after the murder. They're in sort of a bizarre context where he made some also really bizarre claims about working for the CIA and so I don't know if Zachary's statements were like a smoking gun because they could have just been viewed as sort of weird puffery. I don't think we had true confirmation until we get back to 2020 and Webb's renewed look at the case. But in any event, there's no indication. The medical examiner said that even if there's a homicide, you know, when there's an obvious cause of death like a drug overdose, the tissues aren't preserved for more than 2 years. And I think the Supreme Court has said there's no duty to preserve evidence unless there's some indication it would be like, you would have to know it had some exculpatory value. And there's no indication here that they would have any exculpatory value when there was an obvious overdose cause. And if the court has no further questions, the United States would respectfully request that this court affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Mr. Johnson, you've saved 5 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'd like to just follow up on the government's position that there was no exculpatory value to the lab reports, which again you argue were spoiled or destroyed in bad faith. What exculpatory value does your client claim those lab reports had in his favor?
Well, it's hard to, when, you know, the defense has right to equal access to the evidence. And we had an expert testify, and he basically said because the evidence was not available to him, he could not actually even make a determination of cause of death. So, and the thing that is the problem, and I see it from the defense point of view on the destruction of evidence is, much of the case law on that is unless you actually have a law enforcement officer come in and basically admit, yeah, we destroyed it because it had evidence beneficial to the other side and the defendant, nothing happens. So, I mean, short of that, of a smoking gun admission by law enforcement that they maliciously destroyed it to eliminate evidence, you're never going to have any consequences for the negligent destruction of evidence.
I mean, the problem for you here is that we have two separate sovereigns acting, right? And we have a county and a sheriff who's closed an investigation, thinks it's an accidental death. Agencies are entitled to destroy records at some point under document retention policies. And the feds may well have suspected that there was something else here, but that doesn't mean that the county, who had the retention policy, shared that view.
Well, as far as it goes, I agree with that, but I can't imagine that if the Florida Department of Law Enforcement had called or wrote a letter to the agency that they wouldn't have went ahead and preserved that.
That doesn't evidence. Strike me, though, as bad faith. That strikes me as, at most, negligence.
Okay.
I mean, isn't that fatal to your position?
If we were trying to exclude the evidence completely, I think you could say that. But I think there's got to be some kind of middle ground here where just pure negligence.
Do you want to address the problem of this possibly being on plain error review? Because that's another problem, it seems like, for you.
Okay. Well, I would argue that since it was brought up during the trial, the fact that it was not brought up just at the
it was brought up pre-trial, right? It's a pretrial request.
Well, I think it was brought up during the trial. I know that it wasn't brought up during the instruction phase when we went over the jury instructions, but I, at least to my recollection, I thought it was brought up at some point during the trial.
I thought the district court denied the pretrial request, told you that it could be raised again later during trial, but it wasn't.
Okay.
Let's just assume for purposes of this argument that you don't have a plain error problem. You don't have that. And we're going to just review it in the ordinary course as we would review.
Well,
are you aware of any cases where a court has held that an adverse inference instruction is available in a criminal case when on a showing of negligence only?
The only thing that I'm aware of is that there was jury instruction in a case. I don't know whether it was just based upon negligence or not, but
isn't
I do
that
not
important? I mean, yeah, even in the civil realm, it has to be based on bad faith. You have to make a showing of bad faith. And so I'm wondering what you rely on to support your position that it's enough that you have negligence that results in a spoliation.
Well, I was trying to get the court to break new ground, I guess, on that issue.
Well, I appreciate your candor in that.
All right. As far as the 404B, I wanted prejudice. I wanted to address that quickly. We feel there's inherent prejudice in the fact that this issue is not involved in trial, because you got a trial like this, you've got probably a dozen things or more that you're thinking about during the trial, and then to be distracted by the 404B evidence, which the court says it was 404B, puts the defense at a disadvantage. Also, regarding the Rule 403 evidence, I think it's substantially more prejudicial than probative. It seems that the character or the likelihood that Mr. Jones would kill a witness was increased by what happened. May I finish? And also, I would request ultimately that the result be a mistrial on the counts that went to trial and a new sentencing hearing on the drug counts, because I don't believe the sentences that were imposed would have been imposed if the jury had not come back guilty on the death.
Let me, you're talking about the haste of all of this. I thought that the pretrial brief, which recounted Reed's expected testimony and the jury instructions, were filed 126 days before trial.
I don't think that's even possible, because the whole incident regarding Mr. Reed and Mr. Fay was maybe about 2 weeks before trial, I thought. That was something we received couple weeks prior to trial, because it just happened, apparently, or they just found out about it. So I don't think it was by any means.
We'll look at the record.
Okay. Well, obviously the record has the best recollection of that, but as I recall, it was shortly a couple weeks before trial.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. You are court appointed, and
yes,
we appreciate
sir.
You taking the appointment and discharging your responsibility today.
You're welcome, Your Honor. Thank you.
Securities and Exchange Commission versus Almagarby.